for sure. Oh, sorry, what? Oh, we're on the air? Oh, okay. All right, off you go, girls. Wait for me in the grotto. I'll be through here in half an hour or so.
Good.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's
good. Oh my gosh. Sorry, folks. Those are my personal assistants, Mandy, Candy, and Brandy. Our editorial conference just ran slightly over time there.
See you later, girls.
Okay, here we are with another edition of Radio Derb. This is your insouciantly genial host, John Derbyshire, bringing you the news of the hour. Let's see what's been happening. We all have our little hobby horses here at National Review Online. Andy McCarthy keeps us up to date on the jihadis. Mark Stein crunches the demographic numbers for us. Jonah shows us where the liberals are hiding, and so on. My own hobby horse is... well, you know what it is. Get a government job. Capitalism's finished, unless you can get an internship at Goldman Sachs, and half of them are really working for the government now, if you look closely. So make sure you tell your kids, if you want them to have any kind of a future, get a government job. Well, here comes more confirmation. I personally, obviously, don't need it. But as part of the service we provide, I'll direct the attention of any doubters to Thursday's New York Times, page A14. Quote, "While the private sector has shed 6.9 million jobs since the beginning of the recession, state and local governments have expanded their payrolls and added 110,000 jobs, according to a report issued Thursday by the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government." End quote. Yes, sirree, Bob. While you're selling off the family silver, your neighbour the bureaucrat is buying his maid a Lexus. But surely this is only a blue state thing, right? This wouldn't be happening in a solid red state like, say, Idaho, would it? With a Republican governor and two Republican senators? Well, I'm sorry, listeners. You know how I hate to burst your bubbles, but the New York Times story tells us that, quote, "The Boise area lost 20,000 jobs in the year ending in June, the Idaho Labor Department said, and saw real gains only in government, which had an increase of 1,400 jobs, mostly in the public schools." Now, I've been taking some lessons in Microsoft Excel from Mark Stein so that I can do some demographic number crunching of my own. Based on my calculations, the last private sector worker in the USA will be laid off round about October 24th, 2018, just as my kids are entering the workforce. The layoff will come as a relief to that worker, as his income taxes will have been supporting the other 300 million of us. So, once again, folks, be sure to tell the kiddies, get a government job. Iraq is booming. Yep, there goes another one. In accordance with administration strategy to get out of the bad war ASAP while keeping the good war going, US troops, oh, I beg your pardon, I mean coalition troops. We mustn't forget the Romanians and Mongolians. Coalition troops withdrew from police duties at the end of June, leaving Iraq's cities to Iraqi security forces, who have the situation well in hand. Unfortunately, the phrase "well in hand" translates into Arabic as, "Hey, I have a government job. Now I get paid for doing nothing. and I can collect bribes for doing people the favour of not beating them up and smashing their car windows. Hence the situation this week, when two colossal truck bombs went off in the most heavily fortified area of central Baghdad, coordinated with mortar attacks on government targets. 95 Iraqis were killed and nearly 600 injured. One of the truck bombs left a crater 10 feet deep and 30 feet in diameter. Some of the mortar rounds landed inside the super-safe green zone. Radical Sunni groups, including Al-Qaeda, are generally supposed to be behind these atrocities, as they were behind the bombing in Kirkuk at the end of June, when 25 people were killed by a truck bomb in a marketplace. People are still arguing, well, a few people are, about whether the Iraq war was a good idea or not. Wherever you come down on that question, it's hard not to think that the real fundamental problem here is that Iraq was a bad idea. Well, Dear Leader says that we'll be out of there completely by the end of 2011. Can't be soon enough for me. How on earth did a perfectly routine piece of gunboat diplomacy turn into a 9-year occupation? Let's leave the Iraqis to blow each other up in peace. Here's a wee history pop quiz, listeners. What major political event happened 36 years ago this October? Give up? Yeah, well, these things are easily forgotten. What happened was, for the one and only time in US history, a vice president of the United States resigned because of criminal charges against him. That was Spiro Agnew, of course. The charges related to bribes Agnew had taken when he was a county and state executive in Maryland. For an ambitious rising young politician in a city like Baltimore, with an easygoing attitude to the relationship between power and money, there are many temptations. Baltimore isn't the only city that applies to, of course. If I sit down and think real hard, I bet I can come up with another one. Chicago, that toddling town. One interesting architectural feature of downtown Chicago is a building with an odd triangular shape at the intersection of Clark and Van Buren streets. This is the Metropolitan Correctional Center, a federal remand facility. Among other occupants, it houses Tony Rezko, the Chicago developer found guilty last June on 16 charges arising from corruption and kickback schemes with power players in his city and state. But now, hold on there a minute. If this guy was convicted over a year ago, what's he doing in a remand facility? Hasn't he been sentenced yet? No, he hasn't. A sentencing date was originally set for last September. Then it was pushed forward to October, and then it was pushed forward again, and again. You see, the federal prosecutors want Rezko to finger more of the people that he was trading favours with. Rezko, of course, wants to know what he'll get in return, and I guess what he's been offered so far doesn't meet his expectations. What's this got to do with big names in Washington, D.C., maybe having to resign? Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Absolutely nothing, and especially nothing to do with whoever it was that was chairman of the Illinois Senate Health and Human Services Committee back in 2003, when Tony Rezko wanted approval for hospital construction that he had an interest in. I don't even know who that committee chairman was. Some state senator, I think. That's all. I have no idea what happened to him. And I bet he didn't know Tony Rezko anyway. I bet that reorganizing that Health and Human Services Committee had nothing whatsoever to do with Resco's hospital construction interests. And I don't even know why I've raised this subject. Why don't we just forget the whole thing?
I'm not a crook.
What? What the heck was that? Hero of the week is Charles Augusto of Harlem, New York. Mr. Augusto should actually have been our hero last week, since his act of heroism occurred last Thursday afternoon, August 13th. But we didn't get the full news story till Radio Derb had been put to bed. Mr. Augusto runs a restaurant supply business up there in Harlem, and last Thursday, four men came into the place and tried to rob it. They pistol-whipped one of Mr. Augusto's employees. Mr. Augusto tried to reason with them, but they ignored him, so he went to his desk, took out a shotgun, and fired off three rounds. Two of the robbers were killed, including the one who was pistol-whipping the employee, and the other two staggered out of the shop and collapsed. Mr. Augusto has not been charged with anything, and in fact, the city's top cop, Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, has praised him. We get the usual sad little sidebar stories of people who knew the thugs, telling us what fine citizens they were. The mother of the pistol whipper told the New York Daily News that he was, quote, a good man and a wonderful son. She says he worked hard as a construction worker, and she described Mr. Augusto's act as, quote, murder. Then the other dead thug's brother showed up to explain that that deceased was, quote, a decent man who, quote, was loved and loved a lot of people. Well, I guess our mothers and brothers see us differently from the rest of the world. As my own governor used to say, where are all the bad people buried? The follow-up story that I really liked here, though, came from the following day. The employee who'd been pistol-whipped was back at work. He saw a passerby place a votive candle on the sidewalk where one of the perps had died. Our man walked outside and angrily kicked the candle away. "Have a heart," said the lady who'd placed and lit the candle. Mr. Augusto's employee replied with two one-syllable words, suggesting that a certain act be performed on the deceased. Not very charitable of him, but surely understandable when you've been smacked in the face with a gun. I hope Mr. Augusto's business continues to prosper, and I hope his employee will start a business of his own one day, and likewise be successful. And I hope the lady who lit the votive candle will go and do it in the proper place, which would be a church. A news story in the London Daily Telegraph last Saturday pointed up the difference between British and French attitudes to the demands of their Muslim populations. In the town of Emeranville, east of Paris, a woman was ejected from a public swimming pool for wearing a burkini. A burkini, that's the full-body covering outfit that Muslim women are supposed to wear when they take to the water. In England, meanwhile, the trend is towards setting aside special times when Muslims can use public pools. Any infidels who want to use the pools at those times must wear Muslim-style swimming costumes, the burkini and its male equivalent, whatever that's called. Burkino? I don't know. Muslim men, in case you're wondering, have to cover themselves from the navel to the knee. Non-Muslims are sometimes turned away from public pools in England. The Daily Telegraph tells us about 39-year-old Englishman David Tooby and his 5-year-old son, Harry, who were refused entry to a municipal leisure centre, funded by their property taxes, mind you, in Hackney, East London, after being told that the Sunday morning swimming session was for Muslim men only. The French have been fools to let so many Muslims settle in their country, but at least they're taking some sort of a stand against Muslim demands that the national culture be reorganized to spare them any offense. In fact, there's serious discussion in France of banning the burqa. Not just the burkini, the actual burqa. Italy is taking a stand too. In the northern Piedmont town of Varallo Sesia, the mayor has banned the burkini. Women caught wearing it at public pools or at the riverside will face a fine of 500 euros, which is $850. The British response has basically been to bend over and squeal like a pig, or perhaps a camel, since pigs are unclean to Muslims. Meanwhile, how are we doing here in the United States? To find out, I suggest you go to YouTube and do a search on Arab Festival 2009. This is a 10-minute video clip shot by some young men who went to the Arab Street Festival in Dearborn, Michigan, and politely tried to engage with the staff of a Muslim information desk. Watch the video and weep. Bottom line, we're squealing right there along with the Brits. What on earth is the matter with Anglo-Saxon Celtic civilization? Gregory Clark is a historian, a quantitative historian, one of those guys who combs through old records looking for significant trends in the numbers. He wrote a book called A Farewell to Arms, A Brief Economic History of the World, arguing that some basic biology, that is, patterns of mating and breeding, helps to decide where stable and prosperous societies can form. Well, here was Gregory Clark last week in a Washington Post op-ed warning us that we shall soon be hosting a huge, unemployable underclass. Increasingly smart machines, he says, will leave less and less for low-skilled people to do. Quote from him. In recent decades, when average US incomes roughly doubled, there has been little gain in the real earnings of the unskilled. And, more darkly, computer advances suggest these redoubts of human skill will sooner or later fall to machines. We may have already reached the historical peak in the earning power of low-skilled workers, and may look back on the mid-20th century as the great era of the common man. End quote. The only way to prevent this huge, useless underclass from sinking into dire poverty, says Clark, will be to massively increase taxation. Those who have useful work to do will have to support those who don't. Clark doesn't say, but I'll say it for him, that it might help some if we stopped importing unskilled workers. I just confirmed airline reservations and rented two cars, sitting here at my desk, without once talking to a human being. My local Home Depot used to have 5 or 6 checkout lanes, each one manned. Now there's generally one lane manned, and a guy supervising the 4 self-checkout stations. Unskilled workers? We've got all we need, and probably far more than our kids' generation will need. The Derbs are off on vacation next week to Hawaii. 5 days on the island of Maui, 3 on the Big Island, and 2 in Honolulu. We shall attend a luau, climb a volcano, and disport ourselves on various beaches. Mrs. Derb, of course, wearing the burkini I bought her to make absolutely sure that we're multiculturally compliant. Dad will also seek out the place where Captain Cook died, as Captain Cook is a personal hero of mine. I shan't be bothering much with politics for a few days. Although, doing some news scans on Hawaii, perhaps I should. Senator Daniel Akaka is having another try with his Native Hawaiian Government Reorganization Act, which basically is an attempt to get Native Hawaiians recognized for special federal treatment, the way Indian tribes are on the mainland. It's logical if you think that special treatment for Indians is logical. I don't. Now, it certainly is a shame what 19th century Americans did to the Indians. This, however, is the 21st century, and there isn't anything we can do about it now. For their sake and ours, the best thing we can do is to void all laws recognizing Indian tribes as legal entities, tell Indians that they are full citizens of the USA with the same rights and responsibilities as the rest of us, and divvy up federally held or federally protected Indian land and sell it, or just give it, to the people that live on it. We shouldn't have different classes of citizenship by race. Do I really need to say that? And in fact, the natives of Hawaii, that is, persons with Hawaiian ancestry, already have legal privileges under affirmative action. Two lawyers, Thomas J. McDonald and H. William Burgess, arguing against the Akaka bill in an op-ed in the Honolulu Advertiser last Tuesday, actually say the following thing, quote, "Since the avowed purpose of the bill's promoters is to protect existing race-based entitlements from attack under the U.S. Constitution, it is not likely that the new government's charter will include due process or equal protection clauses." End quote. The disturbing thing about the Akaka bill is that it's just an extension of race-based citizenship categories that we've already established. Strike down separate treatment for American Indians. Strike down affirmative action. Strike down the Akaka bill. Let's just have one kind of citizenship for all citizens. What would be wrong with that? Here's our closing miscellany of brief items. Item: thinking of buying a house? Hold off for a while. The Mortgage Bankers Association, and just about everyone else in the business, expects house prices to keep falling for at least a couple more years. After that, assuming they stabilize, they will flatline for several years more. The house market is in real bad shape. One firm of analysts, First American CoreLogic, has calculated that a third, one in three, of American homes were underwater at the end of June. That is, the mortgage holders owed more than the house would fetch if sold. This has dire implications for the banking system. As a personal matter, though, if you're going to need to sell in the next couple of years, sell now. And if you'll be needing to buy, hold off. And yes, I do know the implications of what I just said. Item: more than 1,000 young Libyans gathered at an airport in Tripoli, the capital of Libya, to welcome their hero when his plane arrived. They cheered and waved flags as the great man emerged from the plane and was sped away in a waiting official limousine. Who was this person, and what had he done to make himself worthy of such adulation? Did he glorify his nation with triumph in some sporting event? Is he a beloved star of music or the movies, expressing the feelings of millions? Did he find a cure for cancer, or crack the Riemann hypothesis? No, this was Abdel Basset al-Megrahi, the only person convicted in the mass murder of 270 innocent people over Lockerbie, Scotland, 21 years ago. A deed like that will get you hero status in the Arab world. Along with noting the degraded and barbarous state of Arab society, though, let's also note the suicidal folly of the Scottish judge, who set Mr. Al-Megrahi free on compassionate grounds. The guy has terminal cancer. And let us also note the folly of the West in general for abandoning capital punishment, the only and proper way to deal with beasts like Al-Megrahi. Item. Wednesday saw the final of the women's 800 metres foot race at the World Athletics Championships in Berlin. The gold medal winner was a young South African lady named Caster Semenya. There's a slight problem, though. Ms. Semenya looks like a guy, sounds like a guy, and moves like a guy. Is she really a gal? The IAAF, that is the International Association of Athletic Federations, has ordered her to take some tests. They say it could be months before we know Ms. Semyena's true sex. Months? To figure out if someone's a guy or a gal? I refer them to Chapter 10 of Huckleberry Finn for a speedier solution. Item. They've had an election in Afghanistan. You know, that real important country over there, near India someplace, where we're fighting that terrifically important war and also to make the world safe for, yes, that's the place. Well, it's been a cliffhanger election in Afghanistan, with the ballot-stuffing party running neck and neck with the voter-intimidating party. The outcome of this election is vitally important because, yes, vitally important, so we'll be sure to keep you posted. Item. Also in that neck of the woods, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan is reported to have had a phone conversation with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. President Berdimuhamedov, as the whole world knows, originally trained as a dentist. So perhaps Medvedev wanted to consult with him about an impacted molar. The two world leaders that I'd really like to see together are President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan and President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, who trained as an ophthalmologist. Can you imagine the conversation? Greetings, Mr. President. And by the way, nice bridge work. Thank you, Mr. President. But you know, we can correct that squint. Item, the cost of a funeral starts at around $2,000. For a decent send-off, you really need to spend at least $5,000 disposing of your loved one. That's too much for a lot of people in these hard times, so more and more are opting for funerals at the expense of the town or the county. What used to be called a pauper's funeral. The Los Angeles County Coroner's Office reports a 97% increase in paupers' funerals this past year and a half. The Cash for Clunkers program surely isn't helping. It must have put into a lot of people's heads the thought that if the government will give me a check for my 1988 Chevy, why wouldn't they do the same for my 1933 spouse? So, to my advice of a few minutes ago, not to buy a house right now, I'll add another piece of advice. Try not to die for a couple of years. This is really not a good time. Item. Hard not to feel a twinge of pleasant schadenfreude at the deepening fiscal woes of California. Here's the chief actuary for CalPERS. That's the California Public Employees Retirement System. Telling a seminar in Sacramento last week that the state's public employee pension costs are, quote, unsustainable. future pension payouts will need, further quote, between 25% of pay for a miscellaneous plan and 40 to 50% of pay for a safety plan. That's police and firefighters. We've got to find some other solutions, end quote. I don't see the problem. If California public employees need to contribute 50% of their pay to support the pension system, then they should contribute that. You get what you pay for. At least they have jobs. In fact, they have government jobs. And don't you just surely know that whatever fiscal cataclysm is about to strike the Golden State, somehow or other, the government workers will come out of it smelling like roses. One more time, kids. Get a government job. There you go, listeners. I don't see how you can ask for more useful advice packed into half an hour. Housing, employment, even death. Do we cover all the bases here at Radio Derb, or what? We're trying to book President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan so that we can offer our listeners the latest advice on dental health, but so far his people haven't gotten back to my people. We'll keep you informed, though. Now, I'm going to go unwind in the grotto for an hour or so with Jonah and Andy and the girls, and then it's off home to pack my bags for Hawaii. I tell you, it's a strenuous life here in the commentary business. Tune in next week for a special Radio Derb from the Paradise of the Pacific.